As if a new idea had just waylaid him, Tarou struck his forehead. Why, of course, I was forgetting. If it wasn't for that, you'd be arrested. Cotard gave a start and gripped the back of his chair as if he were about to fall. Rieu had stopped writing and was observing him with grave interest. Who told you that? Cotard almost screamed. Why, you yourself. Tarou looked surprised. At least that's what the doctor and I have gathered from the way you speak. Losing all control of himself, Cotard let out a volley of oaths. Don't get excited, Tarou said quietly. Neither I nor the doctor would dream of reporting you to the police. What you may have done is no business of ours. And anyway, we've never had much use for the police. Come now, sit down again. Cotard looked at the chair, then hesitantly lowered himself into it. He heaved a deep sigh. It's something that happened ages ago, he began. Somehow they've dug it up. I thought it had all been forgotten. But somebody started talking, damn him. They sent for me and told me not to budge until the inquiry was finished. And I felt pretty sure they'd end up by arresting me. Was it anything serious? Tarou asked. That depends on what you mean by serious. It wasn't murder, anyhow. Prison? Or transportation with hard labor? Cotard was looking almost abject. Well, prison, if I'm lucky. But after a moment, he grew excited again. It was all a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. And I can't bear the idea of being pulled in for that, of being torn from my home and habits and everyone I know. And is that the reason, Tarou asked, why you had the bright idea of hanging yourself? Yes, it was a damn fool thing to do, I admit. For the first time, Rieu spoke. He told Cotard that he quite understood his anxiety, but perhaps everything would come right in the end. Oh, for the moment, I've nothing to fear. I can see, Tarou said, that you're not going to join in our effort. Twiddling his hat uneasily, Cotard gazed at Tarou with shifty eyes. I hope you won't bear me a grudge. Certainly not. But, Tarou smiled, do try at least not to propagate the microbe deliberately. Cotard protested that he'd never wanted the plague. It was pure chance that it had broken out, and he wasn't to blame if it happened to make things easier for him just now. Then he seemed to pluck up courage again, and when Rambert entered, he was shouting almost aggressively, "What's more, I'm pretty sure you won't get anywhere." Rambert learned to his chagrin that Cotard didn't know where Gonzalez lived. He suggested that they'd better pay another visit to the small café. They made an appointment for the following day. When Rieu gave him to understand that he'd like to be kept posted, Rambert proposed that he and Tarou should look him up one night at the end of the week. They could come as late as they liked and would be sure to find him in his room. Next morning, Cotard and Rambert went to the café and left a message for Garcia, asking him to come that evening or, if this could not be managed, next day. They waited for him in vain that evening. Next day, Garcia turned up. He listened in silence to what Rambert had to say, then informed him he had no idea what had happened, but knew that several districts of the town had been isolated for 24 hours for a house-to-house inspection. Quite possibly, Gonzalez and the two youngsters hadn't been able to get through the cordon. All he could do was to put them in touch once more with Raoul. Naturally, this couldn't be done before the next day but one. I see, Rambert said. I'll have to start it all over again, from scratch. On the next day but one, Raoul, whom Rambert met at a street corner, confirmed Garcia's surmise. The low-lying districts had, in fact, been isolated and a cordon put round them. The next thing was to get in contact with Gonzalez. 2 days later, Rambert was lunching with a footballer. It's too damn silly, Gonzalez said. Of course we should have arranged some way of seeing each other. Rambert heartily agreed. Tomorrow morning, Gonzalez continued, we'll look up the kids and try to get a real move on. When they called next day, however, the youngsters were out. A note was left fixing a meeting for the following day at noon, outside the high school. When Rambert came back to his hotel, Tarou was struck by the look on his face. Not feeling well, he asked. It's having to start it all over again that's got me down. Then he added, you'll come tonight, won't you? When the two friends entered Rambert's room that night, they found him lying on the bed. He got up at once and filled the glasses he had ready. Before lifting his to his lips, Rieu asked him if he was making progress. The journalist replied that he'd started the same round again and got to the same point as before. In a day or two, he was to have his last appointment. Then he took a sip of his drink and added gloomily, needless to say, they won't turn up. Oh, come, that doesn't follow because they let you down last time. So you haven't understood yet. Lambert shrugged his shoulders almost scornfully. Understood what? The plague. Ah, Rieux exclaimed. No, you haven't understood that it means exactly that. The same thing over and over and over again. He went to a corner of the room and started a small phonograph. What's the record? Tarou asked. I've heard it before. It's St. James Infirmary. While the phonograph was playing, two shots rang out in the distance. A dog or a getaway, Tarou remarked. When, a moment later, the record ended, an ambulance bell could be heard clanging past under the window and receding into silence. Rather a boring record, Ambert remarked, and this must be the 10th time I've put it on today. Are you really so fond of it? No, but it's the only one I have. And after a moment he added, that's what I said it was. The same thing over and over again. He asked Rieux how the sanitary groups were functioning. Five teams were now at work, and it was hoped to form others. Sitting on the bed, the journalist seemed to be studying his fingernails. Rieux was gazing at his squat, powerfully built form, hunched up on the edge of the bed. Suddenly, he realized that Ambert was returning his gaze. You know, Doctor, I've given a lot of thought to your campaign, and if I'm not with you, I have my reasons. No, I don't think it's that I'm afraid to risk my skin again. I took part in the Spanish Civil War. On which side? Tarou asked. The losing side. But since then, I've done a bit of thinking. About what? Courage. I know now that man is capable of great deeds. But if he isn't capable of a great emotion, well, he leaves me cold. One has the idea that he's capable of everything, Tarou remarked. I can't agree. He's incapable of suffering for a long time or being happy for a long time, which means that he's incapable of anything really worthwhile. He looked at the two men in turn, then asked, Tell me, Tarou, are you capable of dying for love? I couldn't say, but I hardly think so, as I am now. You see. But you're capable of dying for an idea. One can see that right away. Well, personally, I've seen enough of people who die for an idea. I don't believe in heroism. I know it's easy, and I've learned it can be murderous. What interests me is living and dying for what one loves. Rieux had been watching the journalist attentively. With his eyes still on him, he said quietly, Man isn't an idea, Ambert. Ambert sprang off the bed, his face ablaze with passion. Man is an idea, and a precious small idea once he turns his back on love, and that's my point. We, mankind, have lost the capacity for love. We must face that fact, Doctor. Let's wait to acquire that capacity, or if it really is beyond us, wait for the deliverance that will come to each of us anyway, without his playing the hero. Personally, I look no farther. Rieux rose. He suddenly appeared tired. You're right, Ambert. Quite right. And for nothing in the world would I try to dissuade you from what you're going to do. It seems to me absolutely right and proper. However, there's one thing I must tell you. There's no question of heroism in all this. It's a matter of common decency. That's an idea which may make some people smile, but the only means of fighting a plague is common decency. What do you mean by common decency? Rambert's tone was grave. I don't know what it means for other people, but in my case, I know that it consists in doing my job. Your job. I only wish I was sure what my job is. There was a mordant edge to Rambert's voice. Maybe I'm all wrong in putting love first. Rieux looked him in the eyes. No, he said vehemently, you are not wrong. Rambert gazed thoughtfully at them. You too, he said, I suppose you've nothing to lose in all this. It's easier that way to be on the side of the angels. Rieux drained his glass. Come along, he said to Tarou, we've work to do. He went out. Tarou followed, but seemed to change his mind when he reached the door. He stopped and looked at the journalist. I suppose you don't know that Rieux's wife is in a sanatorium 100 miles or so away. Ambert showed surprise and began to say something, but Tarou had already left the room. At a very early hour next day, Ambert rang up the doctor. Would you agree to my working with you until I find some way of getting out of the town? There was a moment's silence before the reply came. Certainly, Ambert. Thanks. Part 3. Thus, week by week, the prisoners of plague put up what fight they could. Some, like Humbert, even contrived to fancy they were still behaving as free men and had the power of choice. But actually, it would have been truer to say that by this time, mid-August, the plague had swallowed up everything and everyone. No longer were there individual destinies, only a collective destiny, made of plague and the emotions shared by all. Strongest of these emotions was the sense of exile and of deprivation, with all the cross-currents of revolt and fear set up by these. That is why the narrator thinks this moment, registering the climax of the summer heat and the disease, the best for describing, on general lines and by way of illustration, the excesses of the living, burials of the dead, and the plight of parted lovers. It was at this time that a high wind rose and blew for several days through the plague-stricken city. Wind is particularly dreaded by the inhabitants of Oran, since the plateau on which the town is built presents no natural obstacle, and it can sweep our streets with unimpeded violence. During the months when not a drop of rain had refreshed the town, a gray crust had formed on everything, and this flaked off under the wind, disintegrating into dust clouds. What with the dust and scraps of paper whirled against people's legs, the streets grew emptier. Those few who went out could be seen hurrying along, bent forward, with handkerchiefs or their hands pressed to their mouths. At nightfall, instead of the usual throng of people, each trying to prolong a day that might well be his last, you met only small groups hastening home or to a favorite cafe, with the result that for several days, when twilight came, it fell much quicker at this time of the year, the streets were almost empty, and silent but for the long-drawn stridence of the wind. A smell of brine and seaweed came from the unseen, storm-tossed sea. And in the growing darkness, the almost empty town, palled in dust, swept by bitter sea spray, and loud with the shrilling of the wind, seemed a lost island of the damned. Hitherto, the plague had found far more victims in the more thickly populated and less well-appointed outer districts than in the heart of the town. Quite suddenly, however, it launched a new attack and established itself in the business center. Residents accused the wind of carrying infection, broadcasting germs, as the hotel manager put it. Whatever the reason might be, people living in the central districts realized that their turn had come when each night they heard oftener and oftener the ambulances clanging past, sounding the plague's dismal, passionless toxin under their windows. The authorities had the idea of segregating certain particularly affected central areas and permitting only those whose services were indispensable to cross the cordon. Dwellers in these districts could not help regarding these regulations as a sort of taboo specially directed at themselves, and thus they came, by contrast, to envy residents in other areas their freedom. And the latter, to cheer themselves up in despondent moments, fell to picturing the lot of those others less free than themselves. Anyhow, they're some worse off than I, was a remark that voiced the only solace to be had in those days. About the same time, we had a recrudescence of outbreaks of fire, especially in the residential area near the West Gate. It was found, after inquiry, that people who had returned from quarantine were responsible for these fires. Thrown off their balance by bereavement and anxiety, they were burning their houses under the odd delusion that they were killing off the plague and the Holocaust. Great difficulty was experienced in fighting these fires, whose numbers and frequency exposed whole districts to constant danger owing to the high wind. When the attempts made by the authorities to convince these well-meaning incendiaries that the official fumigation of their houses effectively removed any risk of infection had proved unavailing, it became necessary to decree very heavy penalties for this type of arson. And, most likely, it was not the prospect of mere imprisonment that deterred these unhappy people, but the common belief that a sentence of imprisonment was tantamount to a death sentence, owing to the very high mortality prevailing in the town jail. It must be admitted that there was some foundation for this belief. It seemed that, for obvious reasons, the plague launched its most virulent attacks on those who lived, by choice or by necessity, in groups: soldiers, prisoners, monks, and nuns. For though some prisoners are kept solitary, a prison forms a sort of community, as is proved by the fact that in our town jail, the guards died of plague in the same proportion as the prisoners. By despotic rule, everyone, from the warden down to the humblest delinquent, was under sentence, and perhaps for the first time, impartial justice reigned in the prison. Attempts made by the authorities to redress this leveling out by some sort of hierarchy, the idea was to confer a decoration on guards who died in the exercise of their duties, came to nothing. Since martial law had been declared, and the guards might, from a certain angle, be regarded as on active service, they were awarded posthumously the Military Medal. But though the prisoners raised no protest, strong exception was taken in military circles, and it was pointed out, logically enough, that a most regrettable confusion in the public mind would certainly ensue. The civil authority conceded the point and decided that the simplest solution was to bestow on guards who died at their post a plague medal. Even so, since as regards the first recipients of the military medal, the harm had been done and there was no question of withdrawing the decoration from them, the military was still dissatisfied. Moreover, the plague medal had the disadvantage of having far less morale effect than that attaching to a military award, since in time of pestilence, a decoration of this sort is too easily acquired. Thus, nobody was satisfied. Another difficulty was that the jail administration could not follow the procedure adopted by the religious, and, in a less degree, the military authorities. The monks in the two monasteries of the town had been evacuated and lodged for the time being with religious-minded families. In the same way, whenever possible, small bodies of men had been moved out of the barracks and billeted in schools or public buildings. Thus, the disease, which apparently had forced on us the solidarity of a beleaguered town, disrupted at the same time long-established communities and sent men out to live as individuals in relative isolation. This, too, added to the general feeling of unrest. Indeed, it can easily be imagined that these changes, combined with a high wind, also had an incendiary effect on certain minds. There were frequent attacks on the gates of the town, and the men who made them now were armed. Shots were exchanged, there were casualties, and some few got away. Then the sentry posts were reinforced, and such attempts quickly ceased. Nonetheless, they sufficed to start a wave of revolutionary violence, though only on a small scale. Houses that had been burnt or closed by the sanitary control were looted. However, it seemed unlikely that these excesses were premeditated. Usually it was some chance incentive that led normally well-behaved people to do acts which promptly had their imitators. Thus you sometimes saw a man, acting on some crazy impulse, dash into a blazing house under the eyes of its owner who was standing by, dazed with grief, watching the flames. Seeing his indifference, many of the onlookers would follow the lead given by the first man, and presently the dark street was full of running men, changed to hunched, misshapen gnomes by the flickering glow from the dying flames and the ornaments or furniture they carried on their shoulders. It was incidents of this sort that compelled the authorities to declare martial law and enforce the regulations deriving from it. Two looters were shot, but we may doubt if this made much impression on the others. With so many deaths taking place every day, these two executions went unheeded, a mere drop in the ocean. Actually, scenes of this kind continued to take place fairly often, without the authorities making even a show of intervening. The only regulation that seemed to have some effect on the populace was the establishment of a curfew hour. From 11 onwards, plunged in complete darkness, Oran seemed a huge necropolis. On moonlight nights, the long, straight streets and dirty white walls, nowhere darkened by the shadow of a tree, their peace untroubled by footsteps or a dog's bark, glimmered in pale recession. The silent city was no more than an assemblage of huge inert cubes, between which only the mute effigies of great men, carapaced in bronze, with their blank stone or metal faces, conjured up a sorry semblance of what the man had been. In lifeless squares and avenues, these tawdry idols lorded it over the lowering sky. Stolid monsters that might have personified the rule of immobility imposed on us, or anyhow, its final aspect, that of a defunct city in which plague, stone, and darkness had effectively silenced every voice. But there was darkness also in men's hearts, and the true facts were as little calculated to reassure our townsfolk as the wild stories going round about the burials. The narrator cannot help talking about these burials, and a word of excuse is here in place. For he is well aware of the reproach that might be made him in this respect. His justification is that funerals were taking place throughout this period, and in a way he was compelled, as indeed everybody was compelled, to give heed to them. In any case, it should not be assumed that he has a morbid taste for such ceremonies. Quite the contrary, he much prefers the society of the living, and, to give a concrete illustration, sea bathing. But the bathing beaches were out of bounds, and the company of the living ran a risk, increasing as the days went by, of being perforce converted into the company of the dead. That was, indeed, self-evident. True, one could always refuse to face this disagreeable fact, shut one's eyes to it, or thrust it out of mind, but there is a terrible cogency in the self-evident. Ultimately, it breaks down all defenses. How, for instance, continue to ignore the funerals on the day when somebody you loved needed one? Actually, the most striking feature of our funerals was their speed. Formalities had been whittled down, and, generally speaking, all elaborate ceremonial suppressed. The plague victim died away from his family, and the customary vigil beside the dead body was forbidden, with the result that a person dying in the evening spent the night alone, and those who died in the daytime were promptly buried. Needless to say, the family was notified, but in most cases, since the deceased had lived with them, its members were in quarantine and thus immobilized. When, however, the deceased had not lived with his family, they were asked to attend at a fixed time, after, that is to say, the body had been washed and put in the coffin, and when the journey to the cemetery was about to begin. Let us suppose that these formalities were taking place at the auxiliary hospital of which Dr. Rieu was in charge. This converted school had an exit at the back of the main building. A large storeroom giving on the corridor contained the coffins. On arrival, the family found a coffin already nailed up in the corridor. Then came the most important part of the business, the signing of official forms by the head of the family. Next, the coffin was loaded on a motor vehicle, a real hearse, or a large converted ambulance. The mourners stepped into one of the few taxis still allowed to ply, and the vehicles drove hell for leather to the cemetery by a route avoiding the center of the town. There was a halt at the gate, where police officers applied a rubber stamp to the official exit permit, without which it was impossible for our citizens to have what they called a last resting place. The policemen stood back, and the cars drew up near a plot of ground where a number of graves stood open, waiting for inmates. A priest came to meet the mourners, since church services at funerals were now prohibited. To an accompaniment of prayers, the coffin was dragged from the hearse, roped up, and carried to the graveside. The ropes were slipped, and it came heavily to rest at the bottom of the grave. No sooner had the priest begun to sprinkle holy water than the first sod rebounded from the lid. The ambulance had already left and was being sprayed with disinfectant, and while spades full of clay thudded more and more dully on the rising layer of earth, the family were bundling into the taxi. A quarter of an hour later, they were back at home. The whole process was put through with a maximum of speed and the minimum of risk. It cannot be denied that, anyhow in the early days, the natural feelings of the family were somewhat outraged by these lightning funerals. But obviously, in time of plague, such sentiments cannot be taken into account, and all was sacrificed to efficiency. And though, to start with, the morale of the population was shaken by this summary procedure, for the desire to have a proper funeral is more widespread than is generally believed, as time went on, fortunately enough, the food problem became more urgent, and the thoughts of our townsfolk were diverted to more instant needs. So much energy was expended on filling up forms, hunting round for supplies, and lining up, that people had no time to think of the manner in which others were dying around them, and they themselves would die one day. Thus, the growing complications of our everyday life, which might have been an affliction, proved to be a blessing in disguise. Indeed, had not the epidemic, as already mentioned, spread its ravages, all would have been for the best. For then, coffins became scarcer. Also, there was a shortage of winding sheets and of space in the cemetery. Something had to be done about this, and one obvious step, justified by its practical convenience, was to combine funerals, and, when necessary, multiply the trips between the hospital and the burial place. At one moment, the stock of coffins in Rieu's hospital was reduced to 5. Once filled, all 5 were loaded together in the ambulance. At the cemetery, they were emptied out, and the iron-gray corpses put on stretchers and deposited in a shed reserved for that purpose to wait their turn. Meanwhile, the empty coffins, after being sprayed with antiseptic fluid, were rushed back to the hospital, and the process was repeated as often as necessary. This system worked excellently and won the approval of the prefect. He even told Rieu that it was really a great improvement on the death carts driven by Negroes, of which one reads in accounts of former visitations of this sort. Yes, Rieu said, and though the burials are much the same, we keep careful records of them. That, you will agree, is progress. Successful, however, as the system proved itself in practice, there was something so distasteful in the last rites as now performed that the prefect felt constrained to forbid relations of the deceased being present at the actual interment. They were allowed to come only as far as the cemetery gates, and even that was not officially authorized. For things had somewhat changed as regards the last stage of the ceremony. In a patch of open ground dotted with lentiscus trees at the far end of the cemetery, 2 big pits had been dug. One was reserved for the men, the other for the women. Thus, in this respect, the authorities still gave thought to propriety, and it was only later that, by the force of things, this last remnant of decorum went by the board and men and women were flung into the death pits indiscriminately. Happily, this ultimate indignity synchronized with the plague's last ravages. In the period we're now concerned with, the separation of the sexes was still in force, and the authorities set great store by it. At the bottom of each pit, a deep layer of quicklime steamed and seethed. On the lips of the pit, a low ridge of quicklime threw up bubbles that burst in the air above it. When the ambulance had finished its trips, the stretchers were carried to the pits in Indian file. The naked, somewhat contorted bodies were slid off into the pit almost side by side, then covered with a layer of quicklime and another of earth, the latter only a few inches deep, so as to leave space for subsequent consignments. On the following day, the next of kin were asked to sign the register of burials, which showed the distinction that can be made between men and, for example, dogs. Men's deaths are checked and entered up. Obviously, all these activities called for a considerable staff, and Rieux was often on the brink of a shortage. Many of the grave diggers, stretcher bearers and the like, public servants to begin with and later volunteers, died of plague. However stringent the precautions, sooner or later contagion did its work. Still, when all is said and done, the really amazing thing is that so long as the epidemic lasted, there was never any lack of men for these duties. The critical moment came just before the outbreak touched high water mark, and the doctor had good reason for feeling anxious. There was then a real shortage of manpower, both for the higher posts and for the rough work, as Rieux called it. But, paradoxically enough, once the whole town was in the grip of the disease, its very prevalence tended to make things easier, since the disorganization of the town's economic life threw a great number of persons out of work. Few of the workers thus made available were qualified for administrative posts, but the recruiting of men for the rough work became much easier. From now on, indeed, poverty showed itself a stronger stimulus than fear, especially as, owing to its risks, such work was highly paid. The sanitary authorities always had a waiting list of applicants for work. Whenever there was a vacancy, the men at the top of the list were notified, and unless they too had laid off work for good, they never failed to appear when summoned. Thus, the prefect, who had always been reluctant to employ the prisoners in the jail, whether short-term men or lifers, was able to avoid recourse to this distasteful measure. As long, he said, as they were unemployed, we could afford to wait. Thus, until the end of August, our fellow citizens could be conveyed to their last resting place, if not under very decorous conditions, at least in a manner orderly enough for the authorities to feel that they were doing their duty by the dead and the bereaved. However, we may here anticipate a little and describe the pass to which we came in the final phase. From August onwards, the plague mortality was, and continued such, as far to exceed the capacity of our small cemetery. Such expedients as knocking down walls and letting the dead encroach on neighboring land proved inadequate. Some new method had to be evolved without delay. The first step taken was to bury the dead by night, which obviously permitted a more summary procedure. The bodies were piled into ambulances in larger and larger numbers, and the few belated wayfarers who, in defiance of the regulations, were abroad in the outlying districts after curfew hour, or whose duties took them there, often saw the long white ambulances hurtling past, making the night-bound streets reverberate with the dull clangor of their bells. The corpses were tipped pell-mell into the pits and had hardly settled into place when spades full of quicklime began to sear their faces and the earth covered them indistinctively, in holes dug steadily deeper as time went on. Shortly afterwards, however, it became necessary to find new space and to strike out in a new direction. By a special urgency measure, the denizens of Grants in perpetuity were evicted from their graves, and the exhumed remains dispatched to the crematorium. And soon the plague victims likewise had to go to a fiery end. This meant that the old crematorium east of the town, outside the gates, had to be utilized. Accordingly, the East Gate sentry post was moved farther out. Then a municipal employee had an idea that greatly helped the harassed authorities. He advised them to employ the streetcar line running along the coastal road, which was now unused. So the interiors of streetcars and trailers were adapted to this new purpose, and a branch line was laid down to the crematorium, which thus became a terminus. During all the late summer and throughout the autumn, there could daily be seen moving along the road skirting the cliffs above the sea, a strange procession of passengerless streetcars swinging against the skyline. The residents in this area soon learned what was going on. And though the cliffs were patrolled day and night, little groups of people contrived to thread their way unseen between the rocks and would toss flowers into the open trailers as the car went by. And in the warm darkness of the summer nights, the cars could be heard clanking on their way, laden with flowers and corpses. During the first few days, an oily, foul-smelling cloud of smoke hung low upon the eastern districts of the town. These effluvia, all the doctors agreed, though unpleasant, were not in the least harmful. However, the residents of this part of the town threatened to migrate in a body, convinced the germs were raining down on them from the sky, with the result that an elaborate apparatus for diverting the smoke had to be installed to appease them. Thereafter, only when a strong wind was blowing, did a faint, sickly odor coming from the east remind them that they were living under a new order, and that the plague fires were taking their nightly toll. Such were the consequences of the epidemic at its culminating point. Happily, it grew no worse, for otherwise, it may well be believed, the resourcefulness of our administration, the competence of our officials, not to mention the burning capacity of our crematorium, would have proved unequal to their tasks. Rieu knew that desperate solutions had been mooted, such as throwing the corpses into the sea, and a picture had risen before him of hideous jetsam lolling in the shallows under the cliffs. He knew, too, that if there was another rise in the death rate, no organization, however efficient, could stand up to it, that men would die in heaps and corpses rot in the street, whatever the authorities might do. And the town would see in public squares the dying embrace the living in the frenzies of an all-too-comprehensible hatred or some crazy hope. Such were the sights and apprehensions that kept alive in our townspeople their feeling of exile and separation. In this connection, the narrator is well aware how regrettable is his inability to record at this point something of a really spectacular order, some heroic feat or memorable deed, like those that thrill us in the chronicles of the past. The truth is that nothing is less sensational than pestilence, and by reason of their very duration, great misfortunes are monotonous. In the memories of those who lived through them, the grim days of plague do not stand out like vivid flames, ravenous and inextinguishable, beaconing a troubled sky, but rather like the slow, deliberate progress of some monstrous thing crushing out all upon its path. No, the real plague had nothing in common with the grandiose imaginings that had haunted Rieu's mind at its outbreak. It was, above all, a shrewd, unflagging adversary, a skilled organizer doing his work thoroughly and well. That, it may be said in passing, is why, so as not to play false to the facts, and still more so as not to play false to himself, the narrator has aimed at objectivity. He has made hardly any changes for the sake of artistic effect, except those elementary adjustments needed to present his narrative in a more or less coherent form. And in deference to this scruple, he is constrained to admit that though the chief source of distress, the deepest as well as the most widespread, was separation, and it is his duty to say more about it as it existed in the later stages of the plague, it cannot be denied that even this distress was coming to lose something of its poignancy. Was it that our fellow citizens, even those who had felt the parting from their loved ones most keenly, were getting used to doing without them? To assume this would fall somewhere short of the truth. It would be more correct to say that they were wasting away emotionally as well as physically. At the beginning of the plague, they had a vivid recollection of the absent ones and bitterly felt their loss. But though they could clearly recall the face, the smile, and the voice of the beloved, and this or that occasion when, as they now saw in retrospect, they had been supremely happy, they had trouble in picturing what he or she might be doing at the moment when they conjured up these memories, in a setting so hopelessly remote. In short, at these moments, memory played its part, but their imagination failed them. During the second phase of the plague, their memory failed them too. Not that they had forgotten the face itself, but, what came to the same thing, it had lost fleshly substance, and they no longer saw it in memory's mirror. Thus, while during the first weeks they were apt to complain that only shadows remained to them of what their love had been and meant, they now came to learn that even shadows can waste away, losing the faint hues of life that memory may give. And by the end of their long sundering, they had also lost the power of imagining the intimacy that was once theirs, or understanding what it can be to live with someone whose life is wrapped up in yours. In this respect, they had adapted themselves to the very condition of the plague, all the more potent for its mediocrity. None of us was capable any longer of an exalted emotion. All had trite, monotonous feelings. It's high time it stopped, people would say, because in time of calamity, the obvious thing is to desire its end, and, in fact, they wanted it to end. But when making such remarks, we felt none of the passionate yearning or fierce resentment of the early phase. We merely voiced one of the few clear ideas that lingered in the twilight of our minds. The furious revolt of the first weeks had given place to a vast despondency, not to be taken for resignation, though it was nonetheless a sort of passive and provisional acquiescence. Our fellow citizens had fallen into line, adapted themselves, as people say, to the situation, because there was no way of doing otherwise. Naturally, they retained the attitudes of sadness and suffering, but they had ceased to feel their sting. Indeed, to some, Dr. Rieu among them, this precisely was the most disheartening thing, that the habit of despair is worse than despair itself. Hitherto, those who were parted had not been utterly unhappy. There was always a gleam of hope in the night of their distress, but that gleam had now died out. You could see them at street corners, in cafes or friends' houses, listless, indifferent, and looking so bored that because of them the whole town seemed like a railway waiting room. Those who had jobs went about them at the exact tempo of the plague, with dreary perseverance. Everyone was modest. For the first time, exiles from those they loved had no reluctance to talk freely about them, using the same words as everybody else, and regarding their deprivation from the same angle as that from which they viewed the latest statistics of the epidemic. This change was striking, since until now they had jealously withheld their personal grief from the common stock of suffering. Now they accepted its inclusion. Without memories, without hope, they lived for the moment only. Indeed, the here and now had come to mean everything to them. For there is no denying that the plague had gradually killed off in all of us the faculty not of love only, but even of friendship. Naturally enough, since love asks something of the future and nothing was left us but a series of present moments. However, this account of our predicament gives only the broad lines. Thus, while it is true that all who were parted came ultimately to this state, we must add that all did not attain it simultaneously. Moreover, once this utter apathy had fallen on them, there were still flashes of lucidity, broken lights of memory that rekindled in the exiles a younger, keener sensibility. This happened when, for instance, they fell to making plans implying that the plague had ended, or when, quite unexpectedly, by some kindly chance, they felt a twinge of jealousy, nonetheless acute for its objectlessness. Others, again, had sudden accesses of energy and shook off their languor on certain days of the week, for obvious reasons, on Sundays and Saturday afternoons, because these had been devoted to certain ritual pleasures in the days when the loved ones were still accessible. Sometimes the mood of melancholy that descended on them with the nightfall acted as a sort of warning, not always fulfilled, however, that old memories were floating up to the surface. That evening hour, which for believers is the time to look into their consciences, is the hardest of all hours on the prisoner or exile who has nothing to look into but the void. For a moment it held them in suspense. Then they sank back into their lethargy. The prison door had closed on them once again. Obviously, all this meant giving up what was most personal in their lives. Whereas in the early days of the plague, they had been struck by the host of small details that, while meaning absolutely nothing to others, meant so much to them personally, and thus had realized, perhaps for the first time, the uniqueness of each man's life, now, on the other hand, they took an interest only in what interested everyone else. They had only general ideas, and even their tenderest affections now seemed abstract, items of the common stock. So completely were they dominated by the plague that sometimes the one thing they aspired to was the long sleep it brought, and they caught themselves thinking, "A good thing if I get the plague and have done with it." But really, they were asleep already. This whole period was for them no more than a long night slumber. The town was peopled with sleepwalkers, whose trance was broken only on the rare occasions when at night their wounds, to all appearance closed, suddenly reopened. Then, waking with a start, they would run their fingers over the wounds with a sort of absent-minded curiosity, twisting their lips, and in a flash their grief blazed up again, and abruptly there rose before them the mournful visage of their love. In the morning they harked back to normal conditions, in other words, the plague. What impression, it may be asked, did these exiles of the plague make on the observer? The answer is simple. They made none. Or, to put it differently, they looked like everybody else, nondescript. They shared in the torpor of the town and in its puerile agitations. They lost every trace of a critical spirit while gaining an air of sang-froid. You could see, for instance, even the most intelligent among them making a show, like all the rest, of studying the newspapers or listening to the radio, in the hope, apparently, of finding some reason to believe the plague would shortly end. They seemed to derive fantastic hopes, or equally exaggerated fears, from reading the lines that some journalist had scribbled at random, yawning with boredom at his desk. Meanwhile, they drank their beer, nursed their sick, idle or doped themselves with work, filed documents in offices, or played the phonograph at home, without betraying any difference from the rest of us. In other words, they had ceased to choose for themselves. Plague had leveled out discrimination. This could be seen by the way nobody troubled about the quality of the clothes or food he bought. Everything was taken as it came. And finally, it is worth noting that those who were parted ceased to enjoy the curious privilege that had been theirs at the outset. They had lost love's egoism and the benefit they derived from it. Now, at least, the position was clear. This calamity was everybody's business. What with the gunshots echoing at the gates, the punctual thuds of rubber stamps marking the rhythm of lives and deaths, the files and fires, the panics and formalities, all alike were pledged to an ugly but recorded death. And amidst noxious fumes and the muted clang of ambulances, all of us ate the same sour bread of exile, unconsciously waiting for the same reunion, the same miracle of peace regained. No doubt our love persisted, but in practice it served nothing. It was an inert mass within us, sterile as crime or a life sentence. It had declined on a patience that led nowhere, a dogged expectation. Viewed from this angle, the attitude of some of our fellow citizens resembled that of the long queues one saw outside the food shops. There was the same resignation, the same long sufferance, inexhaustible and without illusions. The only difference was that the mental state of the food seekers would need to be raised to a vastly higher power to make it comparable with the gnawing pain of separation, since this latter came from a hunger fierce to the point of insatiability. In any case, if the reader would have a correct idea of the mood of these exiles, we must conjure up once more those dreary evenings sifting down through a haze of dust and golden light upon the treeless streets filled with teeming crowds of men and women. For, characteristically, the sound that rose toward the terraces still bathed in the last glow of daylight, now that the noises of vehicles and motors, the sole voice of cities in ordinary times, had ceased, was but one vast rumor of low voices and incessant footfalls, the drumming of innumerable souls timed to the eerie whistling of the plague in the sultry air above, the sound of a huge concourse of people marking time, a never-ending, stifling drone that gradually swelling filled the town from end to end, and evening after evening gave its truest, mournfulest expression to the blind endurance that had ousted love from all our hearts.